This is the Patriots All 22 podcast on the CLNS Media Network, the leading online provider for the six-time Super Bowl champion New England Patriots.
Welcome into a new edition of the Patriots All 22 podcast, powered by the CLNS Media Podcast Network. I am Evan Lazar, and I'm joined today by my good friend Mike Petraglia. Trags, thanks for doing this, man.
Hey, I'm happy to do it. Almost shockingly that we're doing it this early in the playoff run of January, first week in January, but it is what it is. And hey, maybe Bill Belichick and his staff will have more time to put together a better roster next year.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought one of the better questions at Belichick's final press conference on Sunday morning was, what are you going to do with all this extra time? You know, you're not accustomed to having this whole extra month. I think all of us Patriots beat writers are asking ourselves what we're going to do with the extra time also. But for Belichick and the team, you know, getting that head start on the draft, getting the head start on free agency, he's so busy usually this time of year planning for an opponent and for a playoff game. Now he does have some extra time to look ahead and get ready for those, you know, things to acquire better players, like you said. And we're going to talk about that free agency, Tom Brady, offseason needs, all that kind of stuff, the coaching carousel as well. But I do want to get some talk here and some final thoughts on Saturday night and just how the season ended for the Patriots. And I think that we've all got a chance to kind of digest it, review it, look it over a couple of times. And I just wanted to get, what was your kind of takeaway of why they lost that game to Tennessee?
Okay, I'll give you a couple of reasons. First of all, the end of the first half, and I know it's been harped on quite a bit, and it's cliche to say that, you know, three plays defines a playoff game and an entire season. But to me, for the Patriots to have first and goal at the Tennessee one and run three plays and not be able to punch it in and actually lose a yard sums up what their offensive deficiencies were all year in the red zone and in goal to go. They just couldn't figure out a way to run the ball. I have no problem with them trying to run it once, but in that particular situation, when it was goal to go at the one, I was looking for Tom Brady sneaking it in. And I know you said to me during the game in the press box, they were stacking the box. I went back and looked at it. I think he could have found a way to hit something up into the A gap and score. That's point number one with me, the end of the first half, and that was followed up by the fact that the Titans went right down the field and the Patriots defense, kind of like the end of the game of the Dolphins, showed no resistance. And they allowed, obviously, Derrick Henry to run at will, and I think he had something like 50 yards of his 182 on that drive. And to me, that was the defining 2 minutes of essentially of the whole season for the Patriots. The second point I want to make here, I said going into the game, James White needed to touch the ball between 10 to 15 times at least. You know how many times he touched the ball, Evan?
It was not a lot. I know that.
He was targeted 5 times in the passing game. He caught all 5 passes. That's great for 62 yards. That's 5 targets, 5 catches. That's 5 touches. He ran the ball once. That's 6 touches, Evan. And when you have a guy like Julian Edelman who's banged up and who's also double-teamed, your second-best option, most reliable option, I think, is James White, and he just disappeared, and I don't understand why.
Yeah, I think the answer, you know, to respond to your first thing that you said, there's two things I want to talk about. First thing is that I have no problem with them trying to run the football down by the goal line, too. I think that's probably the easiest way, honestly, to get into the end zone from that point of the field, because if you try to throw the ball in down there, the space is so compact that unless you get some sort of a play action type of pass off and you get some blown coverage or some misdirection going, it's going to be really tough to just run a bunch of routes and get open in that little bit of space. So I don't have a problem with them running the football down there. Bill Belichick has talked a lot about running inside the 5-yard line and how important and how much easier it is to move the football down by the goal line by running it. My problem with the way that they ran the football was that wide zone scheme that they run where they stretch the defense out and they try to hit it off the tackle is their go-to play on the goal line. They've been running it really for the last 3 or 4 years, I would say, pretty consistently as basically their only run scheme from that close into the goal line. When they get a little bit further out, they'll run the fullback lead play where the fullback leads through the A gap and blows up the linebacker and the running back follows behind. But when they're up on the goal line like that, they run wide zone all the time. And some of the Patriots' opponents, certainly the ones that have Belichick ties, guys like Vrabel, Matt Patricia, Bill O'Brien, they have caught on to the wide zone. They've seen the Patriots enough. They know they've been inside the building. They know that that's what Belichick and Josh McDaniels want to do. So looking at the way the Titans reacted to those three plays, they were ready for it. They knew the play was coming before the ball was snapped. So you should have realized that if you're Josh McDaniels on the first or the second play, right? And on the third play, at least, on third down, whether it's a sneak, whether it's a passing play, whether it's another jet sweep to Julian Edelman, whatever you want to run, it really doesn't matter from there. But running the play that you run most frequently three straight times against a defense that is loading up to stop that exact play is what the end result is that's getting stuffed at the goal line. So I think that that's a big part of it, is that that's a tendency of theirs, and they played right into the tendency for the Titans. The other thing is that Belichick has always preached something called the middle eight. It's the 4 minutes before the half and the 4 minutes after the half as being kind of the biggest part of the game, a big swing. You got the double score thrown in there. You got a couple of different situational football elements, the two-minute drill, things like that. And then obviously coming out after halftime, for both teams, that's a lot like the opening drive of the game. So you have a script, you go into halftime, you kind of figure out some things that you might want to do differently, and you go from there and you make some adjustments. The Patriots lost the middle eight in this game because of that goal line stop. But right before the half, they turned the ball over on downs. The Tennessee Titans, like you mentioned, score a touchdown on the drive after they get stuffed at the goal line, and they lose the middle eight 7-3. They weren't able to they got that initial stop right out of the gate in the third quarter, but they weren't able to take advantage of it on the offensive side of the ball. So you lose the middle eight, you don't execute in situational football down by the goal line and on third down, and the Titans were just better in those areas than the Patriots were.
Yeah, and I think you put it perfectly, that Titans were better in critical moments during that game than the Patriots were. And how often have we seen during this 19-year run that the Patriots are the ones who have owned the critical moments of playoff football, and they just didn't. And to me, the warning signs were there. Another coach that knew what was coming, Brian Flores, the week before in a regular season finale, they were able to do some things against the Patriots, pulling out all the stops, of course, on their final drive of the game, that I think Mike Vrabel stole from the Dolphins and Brian Flores and used it against the Patriots. And the other thing I'd point out to you about the outside zone running, that is something I think the Patriots defense struggled with in the last 4 to 5, 6 weeks of the season. You saw a lot of teams suddenly discover, don't run right at Lawrence Guy and Danny Shelton, run slants and run zones on the outside. And the Patriots did not do a good job stopping that.
Yeah, it was really an interesting kind of breakdown of the first half versus the second half when it came to the run defense, because they were, for the most part, Henry broke off some big runs in the second half, but on the whole, they were able to mitigate what he was able to do in the second half. I think he averaged 3.5 yards per carry in the second half and almost 8 yards per carry in the first half. And I think there was an element, I don't think that this was a full-on no Sean Moreno Denver Broncos 2013 game plan where they were saying, we're going to go with a light box and we're just going to let you run the football and we're going to take the ball out of Peyton Manning's hands. I don't think it was that egregious of a game plan. I think the biggest problem the Patriots had up front was that they have a shortage of defensive linemen currently, and it put them in a situation where they really couldn't go four down. And if they were going to go four down, they were going to have to go with two guys that are basically passing downs players in Dietrich Wise and Adam Butler. And Dietrich Wise got really abused in this game against the run. They ran right at him. They ran right at him a few times with double team blocks. Taylor Lewan, their left tackle, just absolutely dominated him one-on-one on a few plays that went for big gains. And the lack of depth on the defensive line, we talked about it all year with the Michael Bennett trade, with them losing Trey Flowers, Malcolm Brown, and Adrian Claiborne in the offseason from that Super Bowl team. That kind of reared its ugly head in this game because they forced themselves to put linebackers like John Simon and Kyle Van Noy on the line of scrimmage as run-stuffing defensive ends when those guys are obviously playing at, what, 240, 255, something like that, somewhere in that right. range. They're not big, you know, bodied guys in there. So I think that the inability to really go four down with four true defensive linemen really came back and bit the Patriots in this game, because it's not just hanging out at the point of attack. That's a big part of it, obviously. And the Titans offensive line really pushed them around. But it's also then tackling Derrick Henry. So if you're a guy like a Kyle Van Noy or John Simon, who are both strong players in their own right, no doubt, but they're about the same size as Derrick Henry. So they didn't have enough big bodies really to match up with the power of the offensive line and the power of Henry at running back. And it's not the reason why they lost the game, because certainly the offense was more the reason why they lost the game. But really, I wanted to go back quickly to what you said about James White and just the inability to find anybody else to separate. I actually thought, looking back at this game, that Josh McDaniels had some situational play calling that I didn't love. We talked about the goal line thing. Handing the ball off to Alandon Roberts on third and short probably wasn't their best call either. But in terms of the big picture schematic point of view, they really kind of emptied the kitchen sink at Tennessee in this game. A lot of different screen designs to get the ball in their backs' hands. A lot of different kind of either trick plays like the flea flicker that didn't work, or just mimicking a trick play and running something else off of it. They actually faked a double pass. They put Julian Edelman in the backfield, and they kind of put him in a spot where Brady faked a pass to him like he was going to throw it behind him so that Edelman could then throw it forward. Brady then comes back to the screen and hits Burkhead for a nice gain. You know, they did kind of empty a lot of different things that they tried to do. I think the biggest thing that I saw all season long, really, was a lack of multiplicity out of certain personnel groupings. We're so used to the Patriots being able to put one personnel grouping on the field and do 500 different things off of it. And this team, because of young receivers, not having a fullback, not having really having any tight ends that are worth mentioning, they didn't have that same kind of versatility, that same ability to run a ton of plays and open up the entire playbook. A lot of people have asked about this, and I really think, Trax, that this was one year where they really did dumb down the offense to the point that they, as much as they possibly could have. And the routes, they really didn't run a ton of different kind of combinations out there like we're used to seeing. Like I said, they didn't really run a ton of different things out of one grouping either. And Dante Scarnecchia mentioned it when we asked him about Alandon Roberts and the fullback thing when the assistant coaches were available. And he just said that, you know, it's great that Alandon's trying really hard. It's great that he's willing to do it. He's playing his butt off and doing his best he can, but he just can't do as much as James Devlin did. And I think that 21 personnel package, they really only had two different running plays that they felt comfortable running with Alandon Roberts in the game. It was either the lead ISO with the fullback, or it was the wide zone play on the goal line. And other than that, there wasn't a whole lot of kind of diversity there. And James Devlin was the guy that could add that diversity.
Well, and you're not going to run a counter with Alandon Roberts, right? I mean, the one thing that Belichick that I've noticed over the years, he does love his counters running backs who are capable of doing it. Certainly like a Sony Michel, or even to a degree with the jump cuts that he was able to show, I thought late in the season, Rex Burkhead looked real dynamite. I mean, he looked real fast, real quick toward the end of the season. And, you know, that lends itself to a lot of counters, but we just didn't see that.
Yeah, there's no counters. There were some counters, but it was mostly power, which is really not a counter play. It's still a pulling guard, but it's not in the same way where the whole offensive line kind of rotates in a counter play. The other play that really was kind of just nowhere to be seen because of the personnel was the wham play. And against the type of front that Tennessee was playing, I think Vrabel and Dean Pease knew that they weren't going to be able to run wham, so they were able to put a three technique and an A-gap player on their defensive line, and they weren't afraid of that player getting whammed. And they actually tried one with Matt Lacoste as the whammer, similar to how Gronk used to do it, and Matt Lacoste got blown up by the defensive line. And
that's not going to work.
Right. No. So there's no fullback wham, which Devlin was a big part of. There's no tight end wham, which Gronk was a big part of. And so that takes two kind of really good running plays out of the mix for the Patriots. So I really do think they dumbed the offense down quite a bit. And, you know, it was all kind of just it was too predictable at times, and it was a lack of really all offensive weapons. And we can get into all of this in a second, but I do want to talk about.
Can I jump in real quick?
Yeah.
And explain to me why there was no hurry up.
Yeah. So tempo has really worked out well for them this year. But what I find is that they go to the hurry up for the most part when they really like, excuse me, I got something lodged in my throat, that they really like a personnel grouping that they're going up against, a defensive package, the guys that are on the field. The other thing that they did in against Baltimore is loves to kind of substitute a lot of guys on defense and bring a lot of different exotic pressure looks, blitzes, sim pressures, that kind of thing. And a way to mitigate that is to go no huddle and go tempo and really kind of force the defense to dumb itself down a little bit because they're not relaying the calls as quickly. They're not able to substitute. So I think the Patriots like to go tempo when they liked a matchup that they had and they wanted to keep the defense in that matchup. And my guess is that they just didn't see that when they saw the Titans.
All right. Yeah, because, I mean, I've had so many people ask me, why don't the Patriots go tempo?
It was effective strategy for them this year, probably when the offense was at its best.
I mean, weren't you kind of expecting that a little bit somewhat Saturday night?
Certainly once things started kind of going awry and you could tell that it was going to be a slog of the game on offense, that seemingly would have woken them up a little bit or been something that they just could have tried to wake them up. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I just think in watching the games with my own eyes and then going back and watching it on film, I just didn't see enough rhythm in their offense at all to beat a team like Tennessee or anybody. I just don't think where they were offensively at the end of the year, they finished about where I thought they would, and that was a first one-and-done exit.
Yeah, one and done in the wild card round, too, at home, which is never what you want to see. But now we got to move on to the offseason, believe it or not, as we were saying off the top of the show. And I wanted to hit on the news of the day first, and then we'll get into some of the player acquisitions and stuff like that with Brady and the free agents that they do have. And obviously the news of the day, we're taping this on Tuesday night, is that Joe Judge is going to leave the Patriots to be the head coach of the New York Giants. This, of course, leaves Josh McDaniels with one job, the Cleveland Browns job, that she'll interview for later in the week. But what was your reaction to Judge going from special teams coordinator and wide receivers coach all the way to head coach of the Giants?
My initial thought is great for Joe Judge. I thought it was the Giants trying to hire a no-nonsense game manager, somebody who does well with in-game situations that I don't think they feel they've had the last several years. With Pat Shurmur, right?
Yes.
Yes. With Pat Shurmur. And I think Dave Gettleman has one more chance, to pick his guy. What also stuck out to me was the immediate hire of offensive coordinator, Jason Garrett. So you have a guy who is, been around the league, was going to be able to kind of, I don't know if it's holding his hands is the right expression, but Jason Garrett can help Joe Judge with some of the head coaching responsibilities of Judge, who certainly has been close with Belichick. But if there is a question that that comes up that Judge wants answered, Jason Garrett is a resource there. That's what struck me about this hire, is that Joe Judge is one part of the puzzle, the front office and head coaching mosaic with the Giants, very different than the situation in New England. And it's a great opportunity for Judge. And the other thing that stuck out to me is that, you know, your alma mater only goes so far. You know, the situation at Mississippi State where, you know, he was before the Patriots, you know, for the Giants to come up out of the blue and, you know, make the offer that they did. Good for Joe Judge.
Yeah, you know, talking to Joe Judge over the last couple of years, I think the thing that stands out to me about him is how smart he is and just comes off, and just how detail-oriented as well that he is. And Bill Belichick mentioned this, and it was kind of a passing comment, but now, you know, you kind of hear it and it makes more sense. But he mentioned it when he was asked about Judge, that he felt that Judge could coach every single position on the field if he really wanted to, because a lot of people are coming into question about his job with the wide receivers, given how they've played this year. I think it's a fair criticism or fair question to ask. And Judge's special teams capabilities or what he's done in special teams, I think, is really underrated around the league of how important special teams is and also how much work being a special teams coordinator is. Because remember, you know, offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, you're really only worried about your side of the ball, right? But if you're a special teams coordinator, you got all these different kind of units, right? I think it's 6 units that you got to cover, and you got 53 players or 46 active on game day to cover all of them. And then what happens if a player goes down with an injury? Then you got to replace that guy, and you have to have the next guy up, and you have to know who that is, and you have to teach that player his responsibilities. I think in a lot of ways, being a special teams coordinator teaches you how to be a head coach more than being an OC or a defensive coordinator.
Absolutely. And the number that Belichick has always brought up, Evan, is 66. Yeah. You have to essentially have 66 players accounted for. And that doesn't mean you have 66 players on your roster. You have to have 66 players accounted for in special teams when you throw in kickoff return, punt return, field goals, and extra
field goal
points.
Goal block too. Yeah, so there's 6 units. You got to worry about all that. You got to worry about the depth chart with all of that. And you got to be kind of involved in all phases of the game, because if somebody gets hurt or somebody has to come out of the game for a reason, or maybe Belichick says, hey, we're going to use this guy a lot more today on offense than we usually do, so let's pull him off of this unit to not, you know, overuse him, and let's get another guy in there. There's just a lot of moving parts on special teams every single week, and I think it's taken for granted how experienced those guys are. The other thing is what Albert Breer reported today is that Belichick has been grooming Joe Judge now to be a head coach for a few years. He's worked closely with Judge on team building and kind of showing him the ropes of what being a head coach is like. And I think that making him wide receivers coach this year, even though I don't think it necessarily worked out for the team, certainly, and probably having him split duties was not what was best for some of the young receivers on the team. It was really advantageous for Joe Judge, because he, as just a special teams coordinator, we've seen in the past that it's difficult to get a head coaching gig as just a special teams coordinator. So now that he's able to have this other title of being a wide receivers coach also, that kind of adds to his resume and adds that kind of layer for him. But before we move on from the coaching staff, I want to ask you 2 questions. One, who do you think is going to replace Judge as the wide receivers coach? Because I think that Cam McCord is probably going to be special teams coordinator, even by title or de facto, like they've done with Brian Flores or Steve Belichick or something like that on the defensive side of the ball of late, and Gerard Mayo too. So who's going to be the wide receivers coach? And what do you make of Josh McDaniels maybe striking out 2 years in a row?
Well, I think it's going to be Chad O'Shea. I think that's only natural he comes back. And I know you suggested this in your tweet shortly after Joe Judge got the Giants job. And I think Chad O'Shea makes the most sense. He's been in the rooms before with them, and I think he returns, and I think that's a natural fit. And as far as Josh McDaniels goes, I think he's going to the Browns this time around. I don't think he is going to let this opportunity slip by. I just don't. And I think he is, before he were to commit to going to Cleveland, I think he would need assurances from Haslam, Jimmy Haslam, that he would have certain powers that mimic kind of what Belichick has in New England. And it's interesting to me, Evan, because McDaniels has paralleled his career a little bit with Bill Belichick, only the difference is he has spent a lot longer in the middle years between his first head coaching job and what eventually would be his second head coaching job between, you know, Denver and this time around than Belichick did between the, you know, what was it, 6 years that he left Cleveland and he wound up back in New England as head coach. But I think Josh McDaniels is going to wind up in Cleveland. I would never say it's a fait accompli when you're talking Josh McDaniels, but this situation seems to marry up too closely.
Yeah, everything. I have spoken to a few people about this Cleveland opening and Josh McDaniels, and the two things that I keep on hearing are, one, that this is the job that Josh McDaniels has wanted for a long time. He grew up in the Akron area. He's from the, you know, general Cleveland area.
Canton, Ohio. Yeah. Yes, Canton.
Yeah, he's got a lot of family ties there, and big part of the reason why he didn't end up pulling the trigger and going to Indianapolis and other head coaching jobs that he's turned down in the past, because he has turned down a few, the reason why is because his family didn't want to move to that city. And I don't think that that's going to be the case with Cleveland. I think that he's really looked at this job for a long time and has kind of just waited to get his opportunity to interview for the job. And now that they have Baker Mayfield in place, they have Odell Beckham obviously on the roster. They have a lot of good talent on the defensive side of the ball, too. We know this roster. You know, this is the team that got hyped up all offseason as a team that could be a dark horse or even a big-time Super Bowl contender. And they weren't, because of coaching and because of real team chemistry issues, not roster talent. So we know that he's kind of set in terms of quarterback, roster talent, all that kind of stuff. The other thing that I'm really hearing, though, is that he, what you hit on, wants a certain structure of how things are going to work from a personnel decision standpoint. Now, I think ideally he would have Nami overall personnel decisions, and he would kind of be their Belichick, their football czar. Now, I don't think that they're going to go all the way there. I think that that's a little bit much, especially coming off of, you know, some of his experiences in Denver, and now he's been hanging around in New England for a while. I don't think that Cleveland's ready to give him keys to the entire football operations, but a second kind of option there is what they did with Dorsey. They've already fired their GM, so Josh McDaniels can now handpick whoever the GM is going to be, so that somebody that is like-minded, somebody that he can work with, and somebody that can kind of, you know, be maybe not necessarily in control of the 53-man roster or even the 90-man roster, but kind of like a Nick Caserio that's sort of taking the reins of scouting and all that kind of stuff, but allowing McDaniels to kind of...
You know where I'm going to go with this, right?
Yeah, you're going to go to Nick Caserio.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, and Caserio has Northeast Ohio roots, obviously from John Carroll University. He was quarterback there. What do you think? I mean...
It's not outlandish to think that this is a possibility, because in Houston, I know all the talk has been about Caserio going to Houston, but Bill O'Brien has wanted full control of football operations in Houston for a long time, and he has it right now, and I don't think that he's about to give that up easily, especially not to a guy like Caserio who's going to want to come in and have full control of the 90 and be the actual GM this time around instead of what he is in New England. So I really think that Caserio could look elsewhere from Houston to kind of get a job that would allow him to have that entire control, because I'm not so sure Bill O'Brien's ready to relinquish it. And if Houston continues to win in the playoffs too, then maybe he won't have to. You know, he might not be asked to by the owners.
Well, I mean, the other way to look at this is from the inside out. I mean, who's to say Haslam didn't part ways with John Dorsey because he knew there was a possibility that he could bring in somebody like Nick Caserio and somebody like Josh McDaniels, because he knows McDaniels, if the, you know, the details on the contractor are suitable, he could lure him to Northeast Ohio and then bring along Nick Caserio when you have a ready-made 1-2 combination there. I mean, it almost seems to make too much sense to me.
Yeah, it really does. But I think that, you know, it's interesting that McDaniels didn't even get an interview for the four jobs that have already been filled. You know, didn't even get to go and have a seat in Carolina before they hired Matt Rhule. Now, obviously, there was a little bit of a bidding war there for Matt Rhule between the Giants and the Panthers just kind of pounced. But at the same time, I do think that this time off, or this time in New England, I should say, not time off, but this kind of layoff from head coach to now going back to OC, some of the shine has maybe rubbed off a little bit. And I think that there are some questions. Also, you know, certainly there's no question about hiring Belichick assistants, because teams continue to do that. So I don't think that that's the problem, but I do think that the problem slightly is, you know, how much of a kind of new ideas and innovator has Josh McDaniels been, and how much of it is that he's just kind of been running the same system now since he came back to New England. And I think the teams are looking to see, you know, some creativity. Hiring a guy like a Matt Rhule is kind of not outside the box, but it's somebody that was extremely extremely creative in the college game, someone that was kind of an innovator and at the lead front of some different things, especially the vertical passing game and the air raid and the RPO and things like that. He kind of brought that to a big stage at Baylor and some of his other stops as well. So I do wonder if some of the shine has kind of worn off on McDaniels here a little bit.
Well, and I'll wrap up my thoughts on this. I think most of these teams around the NFL knew all along that McDaniels had his sights set on Cleveland. That is why I think you're seeing what happened to Josh McDaniels this time around. And I think other teams were like, no, we're not touching that. McDaniels, we all know, wants to go to Cleveland, and we're just going to let him go to Cleveland. And that's my read on this. It's a very algebraic answer to a calculus-like type problem, but that's the way I read it.
I think that's a great read on it because we just hear about these things as they trickle out, but the league itself has kind of known where everybody's sort of going to land for a couple of weeks now. You know, there's talks about all this kind of stuff way before we hear anything formally being set in stone in terms of interviews or hires or things like that. Like, don't tell me that Dallas had no idea that Mike McCarthy was going to be their next head coach. You know, they've known that Mike McCarthy is a guy they were very interested in for a while now. That's why the move happened so quickly, once they finally did decide that Jason Garrett was probably going to be fired or go on right down the line with a lot of these hires. Ron Rivera in Washington, for example, that one happened really, really quickly. And I think that there's a lot to be said of a lot of this has already been decided. We made it 32 minutes into this podcast, Trex, and we didn't mention Tom Brady's name once until now.
I'm happy about that.
I think given the kind of, wake of the situation here and all the other talk shows, I'm sure, are leading with Tom Brady. So I think that's pretty impressive that we got this far. But I did want to ask you about Brady. Obviously, this is the biggest storyline for the Patriots this offseason is, are they going to get this deal done with Brady and bring him back? To me, I do think that some things need to change for this marriage to continue in a successful way. I think that he could come back. They could run it back next year with the team that they have, probably go 12-4 again and maybe win a playoff game or two. But to get this back to where they want to be in terms of Super Bowl contender and championship caliber offense, I do think some things need to change in terms of what the Patriots are doing to surround Tom Brady with talent and also a little bit of Tom Brady too as well.
I do not think Tom Brady wants to play here anymore. I know that is way off the highway and into the Grand National Park in Idaho or in Arizona or something. But I think Tom Brady has had his run here, and I think he wants to enjoy, find out what it'd be like to play somewhere else. It's just something that struck me toward the end of the year that he just wasn't having fun here. And I think he wants to find out what it's going to be like without Bill Belichick calling all the signals. And and the Belichick Brady marriage has been a great one. And I think both sides would say that and have said that. But I think there comes a time and a place where both sides agree it's time to move on. And I think that's what you're going to see happen in this particular situation. And I think you're going to have a team, just let's say Tennessee, Indy, Tampa, offer Brady 1 to 2 years at $35 million per. And in total guaranteed cash. And if it's 1 year, it's 1 year, and it doesn't really do the franchise a lot of damage. And it's great for ticket sales and interest in the franchise. And I think that's what you're going to see happen.
Wow. That I was not expecting you to say that. I agree with you on a level of that, similar to Gronk last year at times, I would say Brady has been unhappy. I mean, just point blank has been unhappy, whether it's with the supporting cast, his own play as a result of the supporting cast. You know, I wrote about this and I think that, two things. One, I think the Patriots and Tom Brady are nearing the end very soon here. And if they're going to have him back next year, I really do think it's going to be on a 1 year deal. I just don't see the Patriots looking at his performance from this past year, looking at his age and saying, Tom, here's 3 seasons at $30 million per, and we're going to just give
you a way.
That's not happening.
Nope.
I don't even think that them giving him 1 year at 30 plus is happening. If I was the Patriots, I would say two things to Tom Brady. I would say, here's a 1 year. I would inflate the contract they gave him last year for a $200 million salary cap, which is what the league is expecting it to be this season, or for the 2020 season. And I would give him $26, $27 million for one season, fully guaranteed. And I say, we're going to take the other money and we're going to get you some help. And that is where kind of the other element of this entire thing is that they then need to back that up and actually go get him a supporting cast that isn't just Julian Edelman and James White. Because quite frankly, I think we're at a stage of Tom Brady's career now where he's still really good, but he's not the best quarterback in the league anymore. He's not, I think, personally, been playing in the last 2 years at an MVP level. Like we have used to seeing him from maybe, I don't know, 2007 to probably 2017. Obviously, he won MVP in 2017. I think 2018 and 2019 have been a step back. And it's not to say that he's bad or that he's washed up or that any of those type things. But in order to win a Super Bowl with this version of Tom Brady, you clearly need to give him some help and some more. We're not even just talking about adding one receiver or adding a rookie again, a first-round pick or something like that. We're talking about rebuilding this entire pass-catching core around Julian Edelman, around N'Keal Harry, to really improve that side of the ball. Otherwise, I think that we're going to see an offense, if Brady does come back, that mirrors the 2019 offense. And I don't really know what that does for either side. I don't think Brady wants to play at this level, and the Patriots certainly are not happy with being out in the wild card round. So what does the marriage gain from rolling it back and having this kind of same situation next year? I just don't know if either party really wants to do that.
As you were speaking, I was more inclined to change my answer to he just retires.
Yeah.
I just don't see him having the kind of fun this is a guy who is accustomed to performing at a certain level over the course of his career. Does he want to be 70 to 75% of that and still be on the field and still taking the hits? I think the fun gets beaten out of him when that happens, and physically and to a lesser degree mentally. And I think we'll have a long discussion with his family, with Giselle, with the three kids, with his three kids, and see where his priorities lie. I don't know. I mean, it's just so hard to know what's really going through Brady's mind right now. And it's hard, Evan, to guess what his reaction to the hours and days after the playoff loss Saturday night have been. I mean, we don't know. We're not inside Tom Brady's head. So Right. Everything we're doing, obviously, is pure speculation. But when you look at his options from a purely objective standpoint and who would be willing to give him a situation, a ready-made situation to compete at a high level with a great supporting cast around him, I think Tennessee is certainly in that discussion because of what Brady saw with his own eyes. Derrick Henry. Can you imagine Tom Brady being able to hand it off to Derrick Henry and then having that play action capability? I mean, I think that would be pretty sensational if TB12.
Yeah, I think that it's a great situation. But I think the issue is for me with Brady going someplace else is from a football standpoint, he has played in one offense for 20 years. He has played with one verbiage, with one playbook that certainly has evolved and changed and added things over the years, but it's been an Earnhardt Perkins system. It's been from Charlie Weiss to Bill O'Brien to Josh McDaniels, relatively the same system and certainly the same verbiage. So to go elsewhere, you really need to do what the Broncos did with Peyton Manning, and that was said, Peyton, you bring your offense from Indianapolis with you to Denver, and we're going to change everything in our system to mirror what you did with the Colts. And we're going to change the verbiage. We're going to change the formations. We're going to change everything that we do to fit Peyton Manning. So for the Titans, they run a West Coast scheme. they're running a different kind of scheme than what the Patriots run up here in New England. So if they're going to have Tom Brady, I just don't see that Tom Brady going someplace else and learning a whole new offense. It's one thing to learn new pass catchers and to learn, have new bodies out there and have new, you know, guys that he's throwing the ball to. That's hard enough in itself. We've seen how he struggled with that at times here. But then to take that next step to learn an entire new system, that's a whole nother kind of animal that I think is going under, you know, is not getting talked about enough when it comes to him actually leaving. So in order for him to actually leave, then maybe McDaniels is going to have to go with him. Maybe he pulls Chad O'Shea with him and they go someplace together if he has a good relationship with Chad O'Shea and they bring the Patriots offense to wherever they go. But there's a lot of kind of teams that people are throwing around, like the Minnesota Vikings or the Los Angeles Chargers, the Tennessee Titans. Those are all great. The Miami Dolphins as well, who the Dolphins... Tampa Bay Buccaneers with Bruce Arians. But is Bruce Arians about to change his system that he's ran going back 20, 30 years for Tom Brady, or is he going to want Tom Brady to change to Arians' ways? You know, and I think that that's kind of the issue, is that Brady is kind of locked in a good way, in a lot of ways, locked into the Patriots offense at this point of his career.
Well, and the other thing to keep in mind with all of this, does Bill Belichick really want him back? And it doesn't mean Belichick doesn't respect him. And
yeah, it's a real question.
But it's definitely a real question. And we know that he was willing to trade Brady back when push came to shove a couple of years ago when he was forced to actually trade Jimmy Garoppolo. Well, now you add 3 years onto the clock, and you know that Belichick sees a free agent out there that he could sign at much cheaper money, maybe half the money, and use as a bridge to a quote-unquote quarterback of the future. I think Belichick would seriously consider that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that a lot of it has to do with kind of ushering not only the new era of quarterback play in New England, but just the new era of offensive weapons, the new era of offense with the Patriots, because Tom Brady has played in one kind of offense. He's a pocket passer. He's thrown the ball mostly of his career in this Dynasty 2.0 to guys like Gronk and Julian Edelman, certainly, and James White out of the backfield. And to develop a guy like a N'Keal Harry, to develop a guy like a Jacoby Myers, to develop whatever tight end or wide receiver they do or don't draft in April, it might actually be advantageous from a Belichick point of view to do it with a different quarterback. And that, I think, is an element of this, too, is that a lot of people are saying the Patriots need to sell Brady on coming back. I also think that a lot of people in that organization, probably Bob Kraft, is going to have to not necessarily convince Belichick to bring Brady back, but just kind of reaffirm that it's the right thing to do. Because I do think that Belichick is going to think about, you know, maybe it is best for us to start anew and start with somebody that we can develop younger players with, that we can kind of usher in this new era of football. And although I don't know if he's ready for next year, but every single person you ask in that locker room about Jared Stidham praises the guy. And it's not necessarily like the Jimmy G type of praise where it was just overboard. You know what I mean? It's more just like the first team reps that he's getting. He's doing well with them. He's seeing the field well. He's diagnosing coverages. He's rolling through disguised coverages and figuring those things out. He's making competitive throws that are tough to defend, that are making the first team defense for the Patriots work at practice. And those are all really good signs, I think, from a Stidham perspective. I'm not so sure he's ready to be the guy next year, but down the road here, I think that they do think that they might have found something with Stidham. Now, I also don't think it's going to deter them from drafting another quarterback, because I'm sure that they're going to want as many kind of players and that talented players on that depth chart as possible. But don't sleep on Jared Stidham based off of everything that everyone's kind of been hearing all year long about how he's played.
What about Belichick? You assume he's back, right?
Yeah, I think Belichick is in this for the long haul. I think the biggest thing with Bill is, from what I can see, is just how much he loves kind of the other parts of the game in terms of how much he loves to game plan, for instance, for an opponent, but also how much he loves to study draft prospects and go on his little pro day tour where he goes and sees all his friends down in the SEC and all those kind of different elements of the offseason and team building and discovering the next player and discovering the next guy and drafting those players and developing them and really being a hands-on coach. None of that kind of flame has burnt out for Belichick.
Yeah, I think that's important to note because if you're going to make some critical decisions with regard to Tom Brady, whether to bring him back or not, Belichick has to be on board. I mean, there's no way that Tom Brady is calling the shots and Bill Belichick isn't at the most important position on the roster.
Yeah, it's crazy that we're talking about the Patriots might not want Tom Brady back. You know, it's just unbelievable.
Well, I mean, age catches up, Evan. I mean, and we all knew this was eventually coming. It's just that I think this year, given the fall off in the Patriots offense, it was the perfect storm. Brady started to decline just subtly. He wasn't making all of the throws all of the time that we were accustomed to seeing from him, especially late in games. And B, the weaponry around him really dropped off drastically. And those two forces combined to bring us to the point where it's very legitimate that Tom Brady's not with the Patriots next year.
Yeah, anticipation is the word that I keep on finding myself coming back to. And just knowing where your receivers are going to go before they go there. There are so many instances, even on the Titans film, where Brady's back foot hits at the top of his drop and he's ready to load out a pass to somebody. And he just hesitates for that moment, that little second of hesitation to make sure that the receiver is going to break where he expects him to break. And once he makes that moment hesitation, either the pressure comes on him or the defensive back in coverage is already driving on the ball at that point, so the ball is out too late. There's just so many instances of that, of him just kind of taking that extra half a beat to make sure what he is seeing is actually going to be what the receiver is going to run. And that extra half a beat in this league is all that matters. You know, that's all it takes. There's a lot of different throws in that Tennessee game where the ball is not coming out on time. And his back foot's hitting the top of his drop, and he's just not getting rid of the football right away. And then all the defensive backs are jumping the routes as a result. The Mohamed Sanu, the interception at the end of the game, the pick six by Logan Ryan, is a perfect example. Mohamed Sanu was open initially. He came on a little bit of a curl or a stop route back to the quarterback. And Brady was just a little half a second, maybe tenth of a second late to throwing that ball because he just wanted to make sure that Sanu was actually going to do what he thought he was going to do. And that little hesitation, the Logan Ryan, or actually the defensive back that tipped the ball, was already driving on the ball. And once the defensive back is already driving on it, we're too late. If that means that the throw is out too late. And that's a lot of things that we saw with Brady. Before I let you go, Trags, just give me, who is your free agent other than Tom Brady that you think the Patriots should prioritize out of the 20 guys that they have as their own free agents?
Just one name?
Yeah, just give me one.
Joe Tooney. Most important offensive lineman this year. Second team AP All-Pro. He's got to come back. And then I would probably put 1A, I guess, Ted Karras. I mean, if you are of the belief that Belichick values a lot of depth along the offensive line, Ted Karras. But no, Joe Tooney has to be the guy that you sign simply because he's 27, he's heading into his prime, and he has a proven track record of consistency and excellence on the interior line.
Yeah, I think the craziest stat, and I tweeted it out a little while ago about Joe Tooney, is that over his four seasons with the Patriots, remember this includes a bunch of playoff games too, started all 74 games that he possibly could. He has missed 34 snaps in four seasons. 34.
That's unbelievable.
He's played a 99.4% of the snaps for the Patriots over the last four seasons, starting every single game of his career at left guard for the Pats. So he has been just an absolute rock there. Not only has he just started and played that many snaps, but he's played well in that many snaps as well. I know that they've invested a lot of money in Shaq Mason already, and having two guards making big money is a lot to ask for kind of just the construction of your roster and your salary cap. But he's the type of guy that you dream about if you're an offensive line coach. Always available, durable beyond belief, excellent, excellent player. I mean, Dante Scarnecchia could not have created a better offensive lineman in a lab than Joe Tooney has been for them over the last 4 years. You mentioned Karras. I agree that the depth there is important. I'm sure it just slipped your mind that Devin McCourty is also a free agent. And that one's got to be right up there with Tooney.
But
as well.
I mean, but if you're telling me one name, I'm going to go with Joe Tooney, because sure. Devin McCourty's 33. And, yeah. You know, when next year comes around, are you going to be wanting to pay a 34-year-old, 33-year-old free safety north of $10 million bucks?
It's a fair point, and he's another one of those players, and this happened with a lot of defensive players. I don't want to pick on Devin only, but he was one of those players, too, that started really hot in the season and then sort of flamed out. Now, I think that a lot of what starting hot in the beginning of the year, the ball is just kind of finding him. That's what led to a lot of those interceptions, and that's just kind of the way it goes sometimes, you know, the roll of the dice, and that's separate, in my opinion, from him, you know, me saying that he didn't play as well in the second half of the season. I'm not talking about interceptions. That type of stuff, especially for a safety, is just if the ball is in your area and you even have a chance to make a play on the ball. But one thing I will say about Devin is that he is basically the quarterback of the secondary.
You beat me to the punch. I mean,
he is as
his value hard, is that.
Yeah. He's basically the defensive coordinator of the back end, and Dante Hightower is the play caller of the front seven, and their communication back and forth and Devin's ability to get the Patriots into the right coverage and make the right adjustments on the fly on the field is a big part of the reason as to why that group is in such unison all the time and why they're such an effective group. So even though he might, you know, lose a step over the life of the next contract, he might not be the same dominant player, I do think there's a lot to be said for the fact that him, in terms of his leadership and his coaching on the field and his ability to make those calls. I'm sure other guys like Daron Harmon, who's been in the system for a long time, or Patrick Chung could do it. But, you know, the reason why that group is so good is because of that veteran continuity and because of Devin's leadership. So I think that, you know, we both agree that has to be mentioned. This has been a great time. I love this time of year, even though I hate that the Patriots aren't playing football anymore. I really do enjoy the offseason. I enjoy the buzz. I enjoy the trade rumors and then the trades themselves and the free agent signings and the draft. Obviously, everyone knows I'm a big fan of. But thanks again for doing this, buddy. And is there anything that you want to plug or let people know of or anything else like that?
Follow me on Twitter at Trags, T-R-A-G-S. Evan, it is an honor and a privilege covering the Patriots beat with you. I got to tell you, you know, all kidding aside, and I know I bust your chops all the time on the beat and in the press box, certainly on game days, but I've learned a lot.
Thank you. Yeah, I learned a lot from you, too. You keep me grounded. You know, I can get a little bit carried away or a little bit lost in my...
Yeah, I tell you to take a deep breath once in a while. I think I don't tell you that as much as I tell it to our buddy Alex Barth, but I do tell you occasionally, take a deep breath.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely helps, and it stinks that the run is over for this season. I'm not saying the dynasty is over. Don't freak out on me, people. But it does stink that, you know, I love game day more than any other day of the week because I get to watch the game with you guys and obviously go through the whole thing, pregame, postgame, all that kind of stuff with you and Sierra and Alex. So it's always a blast down there, and I'm looking forward to doing it again next season here on Pats All 22. As a lot of you know, in the past, we're a heavy draft podcast. I promise you that we're going to turn the page to the draft at some point very soon here in the next couple of weeks. We'll obviously stay current with the news with coaching hires and different trades and free agency when that comes around. So we're going to try to keep as busy as possible on the podcast, and we'll certainly hit the draft heavy come around late February when the combine gets underway, and that's really where the Patriots are at right now, is rebuilding this roster and rebuilding everything that they have kind of started here in the Dynasty 2.0. and I think that it's not quite over yet. I do think that there are some ways, avenues, certainly, that would you be surprised, Trags, if we're here next year and they're in the AFC Championship game again?
I would not be. If they brought back the right pieces and built around Tom Brady, I would not be surprised.
I would not be surprised at all. And I also just want to thank everybody for listening to the pod this season. It's been a great season. Obviously, didn't end the way that we all wanted it to end. I would have liked to have continued to, as well, and been able to work a couple more playoff games. But we are going to be here all offseason for you. But until next time, signing off from Mike Petraglia, I'm Evan Lazar. Thanks for listening.